Hello, hello, and welcome to the 9th episode of Pints of Football. How are we doing this week, Ayusha?
I'm doing well, Imamshu. My partner came back from Luxembourg. Finally, we are united together in India after a year. And boy, was I glad that I was spending time with her last night and I got to miss the Chelsea-Arsenal game. And I'm really happy that she is here with me to ride out the rest of this disappointing season with Chelsea. But apart from the disappointment and depression that is Chelsea, what a wonderful week we have had. All the mayhem happened in the best league in the world. We had Liverpool Tottenham 4-3. We had Manchester United giving Aston Villa their first defeat in 11 games. We had the title race being turned upside down. And then we had all the drama with Messi in Paris. And obviously, the tumbling and constant back and forth of the Bundesliga top table.
Yeah, a lot of events to discuss this week for sure. It's a good thing for you that you're having a mixed week. Let's see what Chelsea has in store in the next coming
minutes. Love triumphs all disappointments. I'm really banking on that.
Let's see how this one goes. So where do we begin?
I think we have to begin in a game which probably was not the game of the highest quality, but it definitely was the best game of the season. Liverpool versus Tottenham at Anfield. The game finished 4-3. For those of you who skipped this roller coaster of a game, Liverpool were leading 3-0 after 15 minutes. And then Tottenham, by the way, they were again down 2-0 inside the first half an hour. Last week, they were down 2-0 to Manchester United. This week, they were down 3-0 to Liverpool. That is after they were down 5 goals to Newcastle just over a week back inside 20 minutes. But this time, Tottenham managed to mount a comeback. Richarlison equalized in the 93rd minute. Celebrated his first goal of the season. Pulled his t-shirt off. The entire travelling support went mad only for Liverpool to land the sucker punch. Tottenham made a terrible back pass in the final minute of the game. An error only Tottenham can make. Diogo Jota scored the fourth goal in the last minute. Liverpool won 4-3. Jurgen Klopp celebrated, pulled his hamstring. There were fights and comments about the referee. Klopp faces a long-term ban. There were two possible red cards with the referee. Do not you name any kind of chaos and mayhem you want, everything went down in this 90-minute period.
It's a wonderful game for the neutrals. So where do we start? In the first 15 minutes, again, they were 3 goals down. It just seemed like a repeat of what happened at Newcastle. I even saw a lot of Tottenham fans were exiting.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't even know should I feel good for them or bad for them, because Tottenham did mount an amazing comeback in the second half, only for them to lose in the end again.
It is the history of the Tottenham.
Always. It's such a Spursy thing to do badly, give their fans a lot of hope, do some amazing things and then lose it at the end. And yeah, as Linkin Park always said, in the end, it doesn't even matter.
That was a great segue, Mamshu. Moving away from the roller coaster of emotions and mayhem and chaos in this game, one thing which emerged in this game, especially over the first 30 to 40 minutes when Liverpool were playing extremely well, was this new Liverpool that Klopp is trying to fashion. And we might have seen this, you know, earlier in the season if some of his players would have been fit. But a couple of things stood out for me. First was the return of Luis Diaz. He immediately took his place on the left. We had Mo Salah on the right as usual. To the center, we had Cody Gakpo. With this front three and now Diogo Jota also being fit, what we probably have is Klopp's preferred front four. Or, right, the front three with Jota probably being the first replacement. And this begs the question is, what is the future of Darwin Nunez, their marquee signing? Do you think next season, when all of these players will be fit, will he have a future at Liverpool, or is this just going to be a bad investment? And it's a big thing, right, for a club like Liverpool, who are so tight with their finances, who to operate such a tight ship, a £73 million marquee signing not working is a big thing. Do you think Darwin has a future going forward?
I think if you ask this question to Klopp, he'll say the typical manager thing. It's competition for places, and it's good that we have four people of, you know, equal pedigree going at those.
Exactly. Is Darwin the fifth?
It really remains to be seen how much they spent on Darwin. 80, they spent 40 on Luis Diaz, they spent another 30-40 on Gakpo, they signed 60 on Salah. So everyone's actually been very expensive buys, to be honest, Darwin being their most expensive one. It remains to be seen. It is a question to be had. It's not like Klopp has not, like, he has gotten rid of strikers who doesn't really fit into his system, like Benteke went once he came in. So it's not unlike Liverpool to maybe let him go and then get a midfielder for that money. It remains to be seen. I would actually like to see Nunez actually pushing for the top spot. If you really think of quality of these players, I feel somehow Cody Gakpo is a bit suspect. I feel like Nunez is better than him, at least in the number 9 role. But of course, it remains to be seen. Let's see what happens.
I think Jota is a very good impact player. He can also step in when there are injuries. He maintains that intensity. He can constantly press. And also the main thing with Jota is I think he's okay with being a first choice substitute. But it's an interesting comparison you bring on between Gakpo and Nunez. So I think definitely Nunez has the attributes. He probably is quicker. He probably is physically stronger. But what we've seen with Gakpo is firstly, he knows very well how to press, right? Coming from that, from the Dutch football system, he's very accustomed to the idea of pressing. And secondly, at this point of time, at least in his career, he seems to be a player with higher gay footballing IQ. I mean, we have to forget that he was the captain of PSV Eindhoven when he was in the Dutch league. So he's a player who's somewhat seasoned, responsible, and probably at this point of time has also a higher game IQ than Nunez. So I agree with you, it remains to be seen. But I think Nunez will really have to start delivering his worth in goals to actually go ahead and claim his spot back in the Liverpool team.
Yeah, you have to forgive us if you're hearing dog panting noises in the background. Ayush's dog Leo is really excited to have me back in his house. Coming back to the point, of course, yeah, it really remains to be seen, especially because I somehow feel Darwin Nunez was under a lot of pressure being compared to Haaland at the start of the season.
Exactly.
While Gakpo came in with slightly lesser expectations, so he had freedom to express himself. But yeah, the next season will probably bring forth our answer.
Moving on from this, how Liverpool's front four lineup or the front three lineup, another question or another tactical nuance we have been seeing for Klopp, and it's been something that a lot of us have been clamoring for a very long time, is seeing more of Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield. And on this podcast, we've made a lot of fun of goals being conceded on Trent's side. But Klopp now finally seems to be playing a system where, while attacking, Trent is occupying pretty much a very prominent and fixed position in midfield. And either Konate or Henderson have been dropping back so that when there's a transition in play, they are occupying that right back position, right wing back position. And the pressure of tracking back as a primary defender is no longer on Trent.
Correct.
And we have seen the performances improve, right, over the past 2-3 games. So is this the future of... First of all, Himanshu, how do you think this has been playing out? Are you a fan of this tactic? And secondly...
He experimented with this in the Arsenal game. Did well, at least the goals that were conceded were not Trent's fault. So that was a big change. And it has worked out against slightly, let's say, weaker teams like Leeds, Nottingham Forest and West Ham. It worked out okay with Tottenham. I still say they kind of got lucky with the last goal, but now I think I understand where you're trying to go. Like, do they buy maybe a right back and then, you know, push Trent permanently into midfield, because there is a budget constraint on how many midfielders and how the quality of midfielders they can buy. So maybe Trent is the solution there. So that kind of remains to be seen. But again, I feel like if this works out, this is probably a cheaper way to have Trent on the right back side while they're buying proper marquee midfielders who can kind of fill in the position for a longer duration. So yeah, I think Trent will again still fit into right back itself next season.
Oh, I really am of the view that we've seen too many errors now from Trent Alexander-Arnold on the right back position or the right wing back position, depending upon how Klopp lines up his team. And on the other hand, we have had a history of players who moved from wing-back positions into midfield. Like Gareth Bale is a classic example. I don't think Trent has the goal-scoring ceiling of Bale. But in terms of his ball-crossing ability, I think he definitely is somebody who can be of extreme, extreme, extreme importance to that Liverpool midfield. And that also shows up Klopp's defense, right? As you mentioned, they might end up buying a right-back next season, because buying a high-quality midfielder can turn out to be a very, very expensive option. So I definitely think Trent in midfield is something he might go ahead with, especially considering they had to drop out of the race to sign Jude Bellingham because of finances. So yeah, that money factor and the fact that Trent is so good in those attacking positions, I think we might see at least Klopp begin next season with Trent in the midfield.
Correct. I mean, if you have to make like-to-like comparisons, maybe not Gareth Bale, but Philipp Lahm and Joshua Kimmich are people who have made similar transition. But then again, these two excelled at right back and then moved into midfield because they were better at it. Trent hasn't really excelled on the defensive part, at least.
But I think that's where one of the strengths, I think we've seen the Klopp team over the years, it's not always that he has the best players, but he creates a system where the weaknesses of his players is not exposed to that extent.
Right.
So that is where I think that's why I have this feeling that Trent in midfield is something he might stick to, also because at the end of the day, Trent Alexander-Arnold is a high quality world class footballer. So
yeah,
and Klopp under no circumstances want Trent to leave the club.
Right. I mean, yeah, I guess it's still going to be Trent at right back. Maybe in transition, he might move into midfield. But yeah, let's see how this kind of plays out for Liverpool.
The last question over here I have for you is, if Trent moves into midfield, right, how do you see that Liverpool midfield lining up? Because I think you and I are in agreement that Thiago Alcantara, for all of his brilliance and his understanding of the game, is simply a player around him whom you cannot build your team for an entire season. He's going to miss half the season no matter what happens. So with Trent being one of your midfielders in that 4-3-3 system, how do you see the remaining Liverpool two Liverpool positions line up? What do they buy? Do they buy another attacking midfielder, or do they buy a holding midfielder to shore up that midfield?
I think they need a couple. They need an engine and midfield, like a proper Fabinho, like another Fabinho. Someone in the attributes of a Fabinho would probably do them very good. Also a Henderson. Like, I know you hate Henderson, but
I absolutely hate him.
There needs to be someone who, you know, sacrifices going up front to just make sure that the right-sided defense is secure. Now, if Trent is tucking in into midfield when the transition play happens. So, in that way, they still need two. One will have to be the solid engine, like someone in a Fabinho
silhouette.
So, you're
saying that a Fabinho is still not somebody whom you would rely on for next season. You need a player with his attributes, but somebody better and younger.
Correct, exactly. So, okay. I feel Fabinho is like a susceptible to a lot of injuries through the season. So we need a younger person who they can develop.
Younger and fitter person, understood. Yeah.
Yep. So that's something they need to look for.
Okay, and also with this victory now, I think it's safe to say that Tottenham are out of the top four race, right? There's no chance that, I mean, whatever minimal chance was also there, considering the points gap, they are now completely out of the top four race. I think what is still alive after this game is the battle for the Europa League spots. I think Liverpool will make it, you and I both agree. But if you look at the table now down below, you have Tottenham. Below Tottenham, you have Aston Villa, and we'll get to their amazing form up until the United game. And below them, you have Brighton, who have three games in hand and who are only 2 points behind that Europa League position. So in spite of this defeat, at least Liverpool have the momentum. I think they will clinch that Europa League spot, but for Tottenham now, they are genuinely staring at the possibility of missing out on European football completely, be it the Europa League or the Conference League.
Right. Mathematically, it's still possible, but you're right. Momentum really matters here, and I don't think Tottenham have that. But they really have to figure themselves out, like really break themselves down and start all over again. And this is not the time of the season to do that. So Europa League, I agree, is probably pretty much done for Tottenham.
They hadn't been defeated in 10 games. Unai Emery, when he took over Aston Villa, they were 17th in the league. Going into this game, they were 6th in the league. If United had lost this game, the gap between United and Liverpool could have prospectively been 4 points. Aston Villa would have been closer to top 4. But with this victory against a very in-form Aston Villa team, United seem, at least now, to have closed off the race for top 4, right? With 4 games to go, they're 7 points ahead. There's no way United are letting go of this, right?
I am, for the sake of, I think I am obviously
biased. Stop being superstitious. Just from a realistic view, it's done now, right? Finally, we can say Champions League is secured for next year.
You will never hear me say it unless it's mathematically confirmed. But you're right. These are good steps to take. I think somehow Erik ten Hag has scrapped together a side with all the injuries, with all the suspensions, with all the Maguires that we have in our squad to some kind of a defense. We are again playing with Lindelof and Luke Shaw, who put in great performance.
Lindelof clearance off the line, I think, was the clearance of the season, right?
That's probably should feature in one of our goal of the season kind of a contender. But
and
yeah,
I think David De Gea also justified his new contract.
I mean, yeah, this is just a one. He has those few games where he does really well. I'm still sticking to the fact that we should go after a ball-playing goalkeeper rather than De Gea, but it's done. So what I'm trying to say is, yeah, Erik ten Hag has this ability to kind of scrap through a squad which will get us through, even though we have so many injuries and so many suspensions and Maguire, you know, being on the sidelines as well. So many off-field distractions. So I'm really glad that it worked out this game. Another fact that you missed is Aston Villa haven't gone in any game without scoring. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's something we made them do for the first time since Unai Emery took over. So stopping Ollie at Watkins and the entire squad was a big achievement on United's end.
The plus point I think for Aston Villa is they easily could have scored so many times in this game, right? Apart from the Lindelof clearance and the great performance put in by De Gea. In general, I think Aston Villa played this game really, really well. They would have been very happy. But on the flip side, I think Manchester United also would be very happy with the performance they put in. Especially, I think Casemiro had a fantastic game. Marcus Rashford had a great game. Also, so I think overall it was a very high quality game of football. Coming to your point about how Erik ten Hag has been able to constantly evolve, but adapt to the different obstacles in his way in forms of injuries and players being suspended, was again at display in this game, where how he's using Sabitzer, right? In the wake of Weghorst's poor form, he's now playing Sabitzer as almost like a second striker. So what do you have to say about that? Why according to you is he doing this? It's A, not a straightforward decision, but B, it does seem to be paying dividends. Like Sabitzer did have quite a few chances, and apart from chances, he does seem to be operating like a threat. He's not important in this position.
Right. I think Weghorst didn't work out in a couple of games which we lost. I think one of them was against Newcastle. So that's when Erik ten Hag does these things where it's not working out for you. He kind of, you know, takes you down for a couple of games. That's what's happening with Weghorst right now. Sabitzer playing like a second striker just behind Martial. It's also because Martial has a tendency to, you know, go to the left side so that he kind of works the ball in, while Sabitzer then sticks to that position. So there's one person at least, you know, making that could be a dummy run, could be an actual run in the 6-yard area. So he that way kind of Sabitzer really works out. And Sabitzer, it hasn't really worked out in a midfield kind of a place, because an EPL, unlike what he's used to in at Bayern Munich, is it requires a lot of running. And Sabitzer just can't do that for the entire game. So he's worked it out. Sabitzer is smart enough to make those smart and intelligent runs. It has worked out so far. But again, this is not the main plan. This is never something he wants to do. He has just figured out a plan B. That's been pretty much what his entire season. I'm really waiting for that point when he has all the players that he wants and he can play the way he learned at Ajax.
But I think this has been the great quality of Ten Hag. And we probably mentioned in different episodes also that we clearly know that the preferred style of football he has, and right now he's playing completely, not opposite, let's say, but he's playing tangentially to what his preferred way is, but he's still getting results. He's still not complaining. He's still keeping the squad together. And I think that's what is needed, I think, from a Manchester United manager, is needed from a big club manager. And what he's achieved with United this season, I think, is spectacular. It's truly exceptional. But moving on from one great manager in Ten Hag to Unai Emery, we mentioned the transformation he's had at Aston Villa. I think the bedrock of that transformation has been that he's gotten Ollie Watkins firing again. And he seems to be now playing Watkins in a more restricted position, right? It's almost like he's asking him to occupy that position in and around the box, not to make these runs between the line. That was an observation that you have had over the past couple of games. So what do you have to say about this tactical nuance again, which Unai Emery has brought, which seems to have galvanized the threat which is posed overall by this Aston Villa team?
I think, yeah, Unai Emery has a history of getting the best out of his strikers. If I'm not wrong, he was very good with Aubameyang as well, even though Arsenal had a disappointing season. He has been really good with, like, you know, not so great strikers, I would say, mediocre strikers like a Carlos Bacca, who's done decently well. He's essentially just told him, you know, just be in the penalty box and wait. Trust that your teammates can get you the ball. That's what he's done with Ollie Watkins. And Ollie Watkins has stopped doing these very aimless runs, which he's, you know, doing for getting on long balls, etc. And now you can see the midfielders of Aston Villa,
McGinn, Ramsey,
and the fullbacks as well, giving him really good passes. So he's just waiting for that to happen. And of course, he's a decent striker, so he can get the odd finishing.
Decent striker. At one point of time, there were a lot of Premier League clubs who were after him, and I really think he has an upside. The key is if he can. I think if he's fit for next season and he can continue his goal scoring form, because if you remember, he began the season injured. Like, there's a big stretch of games he missed through injury, because of which his prospective big move didn't happen. So right. I think firstly for me, the striker with upside, and you're absolutely right. I think Unai Emery has just galvanized this team, and again, another thing he's done is he has made Aston Villa also a pressing unit. Like, they do not do the Klopp style of full metal pressing, but they've increased the intensity. They are going more for the second balls.
And all of this, again, this turnaround has happened in such a small time. He's shown really what a caretaker manager is supposed to be.
And this was from game one, actually. His first game at Aston Villa was against United, and he beat United 3-1. So it's actually been there since game one. So again, I would use as an excuse that we don't have a preseason, but he's actually done that from game one. So hats off to Unai Emery. It remains to be seen what he does next season, though.
But he'll be in the Europa League, and as we know, he has a terrific record in the Europa League. So if Aston Villa most likely will be in some European competition next season, and if they are with him, then...
Or it becomes a distraction and totally blows it. You never know.
But at least, I think they still do end up... If they are with him in Europe, yeah, the Premier League can go down it, but yeah, special things might happen in Europe for Aston Villa. But again, a brilliant game. And in the end, Erik ten Hag doing what he's been doing all season, delivering the results and delivering the goods for Manchester United. Moving on from all this race and the big games around Europe, we have to talk about the week that Manchester City have had. I think you all have had the chance to digest the City vs Arsenal game and the absolute domination of Manchester City, particularly by Erling Haaland and Kevin De Bruyne, who put on a masterclass, scored a brace. Haaland turned out to be the assist provider, took off his hair, became the Viking, scored his...
Yeah, that was some unreal moment, right? He just let down his hair and he scored the record-breaking goal. Yeah, it's just beautiful. Everything's just working out for them.
Yeah, so I mean, everything was. And then again, in this Fulham game, where City were playing probably the third game in 7 or 8 days, he rested Kevin De Bruyne, he rested Bernardo Silva. City still came out there and delivered the goods. Haaland broke the all-time Premier League goal-scoring record. He's now 34 goals of the season, scored his 50th goal of the season. Julian Alvarez scoring a cracker of a goal. I mean, at this point of time, it does seem like it's City's goal to lose, rather season to lose, right?
Exactly. I mean, it just seems like everything is going for them. Again, what I'm only afraid of are those two distractions, the two games they have to play against Real Madrid in the Champions League, and that one game they have to play against United to win the FA Cup. Arsenal do not have those distractions. So we will come to this at the later part of the episode, but it just seems like there is one more, you know, a twist in the tale.
I totally understand what you're saying, because they've also been playing so well and winning for so long. You almost have this feeling, right?
Something might go wrong. Yeah.
Have they peaked too early? Or like, once you're at the top of the hill, there has to come a dip. And this probably is a title race, you know, where they cannot afford that dip. Because they're two games behind, that Premier League table can play tricks on your mind. And they do have difficult games. Obviously, the game against the Chelsea will be an absolute easy game for them. But they do have those last two games of the season against Brighton and Brentford, which can turn out to be really, really tricky games. So, and we know what Arsenal's fixture list is. They went through Chelsea easily. And if Arsenal beat Newcastle in the next game, right? And it's very tough because they're going to St. James's Park. But if they can somehow win that game, then I think the pressure truly will be on City. Because I don't think Arsenal are going to draw points after that. So, I mean, I'm totally in agreement with you. It's also some of these players, they have to continue keeping up that high level of performance. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the rest of the season pans out. We have to talk about Erling Haaland. We mentioned broke the all-time Premier League goal-scoring record in his first season. Scored his 50th goal of the season. I think only 5 or 6 players in the history of football have scored 50-plus goals in Europe in a single season. Illustrious company involves Messi, Ronaldo, Luis Suarez... I'm forgetting one or two other players.
Has Mbappe done it?
Not yet. Mbappe not yet done it.
That settles the debate, right?
My question is, forget the treble. If City even do the double, he surely gets the Ballon d'Or, right?
I mean, it's either that or I'll be really shocked.
In spite of Messi winning the World Cup.
Through penalties.
5 penalties. I mean, yes, he won the World Cup, but there were 5 penalties involved. Haaland doing the double, that has to warrant...
Is this, I always feel, right? If he doesn't get the Ballon d'Or this time, his lack of, like, if you look at all the Ballon d'Or winners, right, it seems like the national team has done really well for one reason or the other. Luka Modric even, right? Croatia was in the finals against France.
Modric won the Champions League. We cannot ignore Messi's pathetic performance for PSG.
I hope that this doesn't happen, that just because he plays for Norway, and Norway will probably not achieve anything in the next 10 years, that he misses out on the Ballon d'Or for that reason. But yeah, I would say he definitely has a shout in.
Yeah, and last question I have to ask. I know we are on this show, while we are a big fans of the way City play, even though Himanshu hates City, he likes the football they play. We both are in agreement, right, that all talks of a treble right now are premature. Like, we can't yet talk about the treble because there are still ifs and buts, and as we mentioned, there's leagues to happen, there's the Champions League against Madrid to happen. So
I just feel the favorites against United for the FA Cup for sure. But apart from that, the two games against Real Madrid, I just feel Real Madrid, if you look at their league performance, which has been very dismal right now, but I just feel like they're saving all the energy for the Man City game, and you know the kind of Real Madrid would turn up against
exactly.
Man City. So yeah, I mean, of course, the treble is again mathematically possible, but then is it something we need to talk about to put more pressure on them? Definitely. I would love to speak about it and put more pressure on Man City and hope they win nothing. But yeah, let's kind of see what happens.
Every year we say this, but I think this season more than ever it feels like this is City's best chance now. I think with the Norwegian brute, the Viking over there, I think this is their best chance. After just dropping, I mean, how many points did they drop? I think they dropped
three
9
draws.
Points in the past 4 games,
yeah.
Right? They finally came back, destroyed Chelsea. Let's not talk about Chelsea's performance. But Arsenal won 3-1. I already mentioned, if they beat Newcastle, then they'll truly put a lot of pressure on Manchester City. But online everywhere, right, there seems to be, and especially if you watch Gary Neville's overlap, there seems to be a lot of discussion on whether Arsenal bottled the league or not. And a lot of people have the problem with the use of this term bottling. There's a whole legion of Arsenal fans who are like, Arsenal haven't bottled, they have overachieved, and now everything will be a bonus if we win the league. And then there's everybody else, so sane and rational, according to me, who are like, Arsenal have bottled. Where do you stand on this bottling debate? Have Arsenal bottled it, or the term bottled is a problem?
Yeah, in terms of bottling it, I do get where Gary Neville has been coming from. He has maintained throughout the entire season that Arsenal will eventually bottle it and Man City will win it. He's stuck to that, and it seems like that's happening right now. I do get where Arsenal fans are coming from as well, right? Nobody really put like focus on the Arsenal team. Because the biggest purchases, a lot of focus was on Darwin Nunez and Erling Haaland at the start of the season, and Chelsea's buys, right? Nobody really looked at Arsenal getting Gabriel Jesus. Maybe it wasn't, of course, it's turned out to be great for them, but wasn't really a big name on paper. So for Arsenal fans, I do understand where they're coming from, but things are, as in business, right? You do reevaluate based on the current situation. So they will feel hard done by if they drop the season, and by definition I think it's bottling it, because they had a significant lead at one point in time, and then they had those 9 points drop, which were 3 draws and 1 defeat to Man City, which kind of it does feel like they have bottled it. So I am of the opinion that they have bottled it.
I think you're being too kind to them. The straight answer is yes, they have bloody bottled the league. It does not matter how you began the season, after a point you have to play the situation. And if you lose the league, if they end up losing the league, right, no team after 19 games has thrown away as big a lead as Arsenal have done. No team has given away a 2-0 lead at the top of the table as many times as Arsenal have done. If these things are not examples of throwing up, if you are creating history in terms of giving things away and giving leads away and giving advantage situations away, I think it has to be bottling. And again, it happened. The year Leicester won the league, Arsenal was supposed to have won the league. They've already done it once, and I think, yes, this has to be a bottling, and all the more it has to be bottling, because with a club like Arsenal, they simply cannot guarantee that they will be in this position again next season, right? So if you're saying, oh, we are developing and developing, then Arteta has to again make this team be in the same position next year, because if it doesn't, then this was your once in a lifetime shot, and you did not do it. You absolutely did not do it. And also, just to cap all of this off, I think up until now, our bias of Arsenal aside, if they had won the league, they would have been worthy winners. But I think now if they win the league, it would just be sad. And I know the table does not lie, but winning the league after you have lost to the second place team twice, it would just feel wrong. And especially when the table is so close, it would just feel wrong. So, I mean, yeah, they have bottled, and after losing two deciders against City, I really don't think they should not win the league now.
Speaking about bottling or winning the league, it's been a crazy season in the Bundesliga, but it just doesn't feel like it's getting that much traffic. Bayern Munich on top of the league because they won a game, and then Dortmund have drawn against a pretty much a relegation side. So that happened in the Bundesliga.
I think we have said it before, right? Dortmund are the Tottenham of the Bundesliga, or as I would like to say, they are the Arsenal of the Bundesliga. They've had a history of playing Bayern in extremely in clutch games where the league is extremely close and they end up losing those games. And now, after Bayern lost to Augsburg last week and Dortmund were back on top of the Premier League, sorry, the Bundesliga, and they had a chance to close out the Bundesliga. You just felt it was too good to be true, right? That they would win their last five games and close out the league. They bottled it this week. Now Bayern are back on top. And frankly, I really don't think now Bayern will not lose these last four games. I think that was Dortmund's golden chance. And yeah, I think now, yeah, the Bundesliga is closed. And in spite of all our excitement that after 10 odd years, Bayern will not win the 11th Bundesliga title, they will still manage to win the title. With all this chaos which has happened at the club, they will still manage to win it, right?
Right.
They will do it, right?
It remains to be seen. As I always say, I've said that three times, four times this episode. But yeah, I just don't want to jinx it. But I just do feel maybe Dortmund have a bit of a chance. But again, it just feels like they don't even want to win it. You know, it's like at least with Arsenal, you can see sad faces. Dortmund, maybe we're not around too many Dortmund fans. I just don't feel the disappointment. But yeah.
It's almost like they can't carry the pressure.
Correct.
And the only time it can happen is if Bayern lose on the last day of the season and Dortmund then win and it just happens.
It's just for them. They just make money out of selling youngsters and, you know, properly scamming United by selling things like Kagawa and Jadon Sancho. That's how they make money, not by winning leagues.
Oh, please. Now that we are on this topic of Dortmund selling players to United, we are digressing from the podcast. But legend has it that Sir Alex went to a Dortmund game to scout Robert Lewandowski. And he came back with Kagawa being his first choice. So for a man who made a lot of right decisions in his 23 years in world football, this has to go down as the most shocking decision ever.
Yeah, so we were moving on, right? So we go to Napoli. Well, we're just going to mention them because they drew to Lazio, which means their celebrations will be postponed by another week. Let's see what happens. I'm pretty sure they are going to win it. There's a little bit of trivia or a little bit of local news going around that there might be an eruption when Napoli actually win the league. So that's something that you need to Google and find out what's happening there. For our ardent fans, whoever's listening in.
And this Napoli win is such a big thing, right? So we mentioned in a couple of episodes that Napoli have this group of ultra fans, right? A lot of Italian clubs have these ultras who are, to put it mildly, slightly more physically and violently expressive fans.
They have nothing else in life. It's just Napoli for them.
And the police and the administration in Napoli is concerned that on the day Napoli win the league, there will be so much chaos and on the streets that they're trying to schedule games properly. They're trying to understand when should they schedule the game. If it's an away game, should they broadcast the game for free in the stadium and pack as many people into the stadium so that there are lesser people out on the city streets. I mean, a lot of things are going on to ensure that this win, which is definitely going to be a big party at the same time,
doesn't cause a natural disaster.
Natural disaster.
It'll be hilarious.
Least of all an eruption in Naples.
Yeah, so that's Italy. Then we move on to the French league. Liga. What do we have happening in Liga?
Apart from PSG's dreadful form, I think the biggest news coming out of Liga has been Lionel Messi and his ill-fated stay in Paris over the past 2 years. So a lot of things have happened with the Messi camp and PSG over the past couple of games. Firstly, there were reports that Messi was in Barcelona with his family. And somebody had the time to count that Messi arrived in Barcelona with 15 suitcases. And obviously the rumors began that Barcelona, he wants to be back at Barcelona. And Barcelona, who with all their debts and with their failure to register players, and they have been selling stakes of their clubs to raise more and more money, now also want to go ahead and sign Lionel Messi. I think Barcelona seems to be that person who has a really expensive taste and who now does not realize the financial responsibility that has suddenly been dumped upon them. But yeah, that was part one of the Messi, let's say, chaos. The second part was Lionel Messi skipped training with Paris Saint-Germain and went on a trip to Saudi Arabia of all places. Now, yes, he's an ambassador of Saudi tourism, but surely there was a better time to plan this trip. And now PSG have finally put their foot down. They have suspended Messi for 2 games, if I'm correct. And they have also fined him his weekly wages.
Like that matters.
But yeah, I mean, PSG,
it's a power move, isn't it? It's just trying to show.
I don't think now it's a power move. They have accepted that Messi is leaving at the end of the season. And
that's why they also don't give a damn anymore, and they're also putting a foot down. And I know earlier in the one of our episodes when we talked, you said they should try to renew his contract. I've always been of the view it was never going to work. I don't think it's going to work on at a top team now in general. But most of all, this was never supposed to work. And yeah, I think it's coming to its fated end.
Yeah, so I think we'll see Messi in Al Hilal, one of Al Nassr's competitors, next season.
And it's what's interesting is, after all the drama that Cristiano caused for his exit, Messi is kind of being Cristiano light, right? I mean, he's being a diva, and that too, in spite of the fact that he's going to pick up at least a winner's medal in the La Liga.
We're
going to
be banned by Lionel Messi fans reporting that we called him.
I am just pointing out the guy is about to win the La Liga. Sorry, Liga. He earns massive wages. And to top all of that off, there are also rumors that his father approached PSG stating that Messi, if he's supposed to get a new contract, should get even higher wages for the privilege of being a World Cup. All I'm saying is, I think, or rather, this is definitely his end at Paris. The fiesta, the rendezvous is over. And if any other football club is listening out, a top club is listening, if you want to be serious about your ambitions, I think Lionel Messi is not the way to go. And yeah, I mean,
so you heard it here first, Lionel Messi to Chelsea next season.
I wouldn't be surprised if Todd Boehly pulls this off. I would be surprised how he financially pulls it off. You know what it is? It's time for our Bobo moment of the week.
Bobo moments of the week. We had several from the same game.
We began our episode with Liverpool versus Tottenham, and we have to end it with Liverpool versus Tottenham because all three of our contenders for this were from this game. Obviously, it was Van Dijk pulling off a Matrix-like flip.
I'm so glad it happened to a Liverpool player because, you know, Salah did the similar thing to Lisandro Martinez and I was very embarrassed. So Perisic did this to Van Dijk when he
Perisic did it to Van Dijk.
Yeah, and it was a terrible sight to withhold.
The second obviously has to be the Richarlison goal, his first goal of the season, as we mentioned, 93rd minute. He thought he equalized for Tottenham.
He did all his celebrations, taking his shirt off, doing the pigeon dance, doing several other things. But yeah, only for, of course, his countrymen to then put in the pass to Jota to convert. So that was all for nothing.
But I think the ultimate Bobo moment of the week has to go to Jurgen Klopp, who, while celebrating his victory, he ran up shouting to the fourth official, and then he stepped back and he realized he had pulled his hamstring. Maybe your age is catching up with Mr. Jurgen.
And it was the funniest scene. It looked like he shat his pants and he was exactly walking around instead. So that was another side to beat all. So there you have it. Three Bobo moments of the week for the first time.
There it was. As you mentioned, our 9th episode in the bag, an absolutely crazy week in the world of football. Thank you for taking out the time to listen to us. Please hit that like button. Leave your comments. Rate us on your podcast platform. And also spread the word. You spreading the word is the only way that we can grow. And now, you can also engage with us on our Instagram page. It's called Pints of Football, where Himanshu is putting out some beautifully made reels about some of the snippets of our episodes. We'll continue posting and you can engage with us further over there. Again, leave your comments and all your feedback over there. Also mention any other topics you would like to talk about. And we'll be back on Monday with our next episode, where we will be breaking down the semi-finals of the Champions League in absolute detail. Real Madrid versus Manchester City and the Milan Derby, AC Milan versus Inter Milan.
Until then, good.